cropper in the unforgiving outback, and the semi-famous Maiden's Hotel, where in 1860 the aforementioned Burke and Wills spent their last night in civilization before meeting their unhappy fate in the barren void to the north. We met Steve Garland at the motel, and to celebrate our safe arrival and recent discovery of fifth gear, crossed the road to Maiden's and joined the noisy hubbub within. Maiden's long bar was lined from end to end with sun-leathered men in shorts and sweat-stained muscle shirts and wide-brimmed hats. It was like stepping into a Paul Hogan movie. This was more like it. "So which window do they eject the bodies through?" I asked the amiable Steve when we were seated, thinking that Trevor would probably like to set up his equipment for a shot at chucking out time. "Oh, it's not like that here," he said. "Things aren't as wild in the outback as people think. It's pretty civilized, really." He looked around with what was clearly real fondness and exchanged hellos with a couple of dusty-looking characters. Garland was a professional photographer in Sydney until his partner, Lisa Menke, was appointed chief warden of Kinchega National Park up the road. He took a job as the regional tourism and development officer. His territory covered 26,000 square miles, an area half the size of England, but with a population of just 2,500. His challenge was to persuade dubious locals that there are people in the world prepared to pay good money to vacation in a place that is vast, dry, empty, featureless, and ungodly hot. The other part of his challenge was to find such people. Between the merciless sun and the isolation, outback people are not always the most gifted of communicators. We had heard of one shopkeeper who, upon being asked by a smiling visitor from Sydney where the fish were biting, stared at the man incredulously for a long moment and replied, "In the fucking river, mate, where do you think?" Garland only grinned when I put the story to him, but conceded that there was a certain occasional element of challenge involved in getting the locals to see the possibilities inherent in tourism. He asked us how our drive had been. I told him that I had expected it to be a little more harsh. "Wait till tomorrow," he said. He was right. In the morning we set off in mini-convoy, Steve and his partner Lisa in one car, Trevor and I in the other, for White Cliffs, an old opal mining community 250 kilometers to the north. Half a mile outside Menindee, the asphalt ended, and the surface gave way to a hard earthen road full of potholes, ruts, and cement-hard corrugations, as jarring as driving over railway ties. We jounced along for hours, raising enormous clouds of red dust in our wake, through a landscape brilliantly hot and empty, over tabletop lands flecked with low salt bush and spiky spinifex, the odd turpentine bush and weary-looking eucalypt. Here and there along the roadside were the corpses of kangaroos and occasional basking goanna, a large and ugly type of monitor lizard. Goodness knows how any living things survive in that heat and aridity. There are creek beds out there that haven't seen water in 15 years. The supreme emptiness of Australia, the galling uselessness of such a mass of land, was something it took the country's European settlers a long time to adjust to. Several of the earliest explorers were so convinced that they would encounter mighty river systems, or even an inland sea, that they took boats with them. Thomas Mitchell, a soldier who explored vast tracts of western New South Wales and northern Victoria in the 1830s, dragged two wooden skiffs over 3,000 miles of arid scrub without once getting them wet, but refused to the last to give up on them. "Although the boats and their carriage had been of late a great hindrance to us," he wrote with a touch of understatement after his third expedition, "I was very unwilling to abandon such useful appendages to an exploring party." Reading accounts of early forays, it is clear that the first explorers were often ludicrously out of their depths. In 1802, in one of the earliest expeditions, Lieutenant Francis Baralier described a temperature of 82.5 degrees Fahrenheit as suffocating. We can reasonably presume that he was recently arrived in the country. His men tried for days without success to hunt kangaroos, before it occurred to them that they might stalk the creatures more effectively if they first removed their bright red coats. In 7 weeks they covered just 130 miles, an average of about 1.5 miles a day. In expedition after expedition, the leaders seemed willfully, almost comically, unable to provision themselves sensibly. In 1817, John Oxley, the Surveyor General, led a 5-month expedition to explore the Lachlan and Macquarie rivers, and took only 100 rounds of ammunition, less than one shot a day from a single gun, and hardly any spare horseshoes or nails. The incompetence of the early explorers was a matter of abiding fascination for the Aborigines, who often came to watch. Our perplexities afforded them an inexhaustible fund of merriment and derision, wrote one chronicler glumly. It was into this tradition of haplessness that Burke and Wills improvidently stepped in 1860. They are far and away the most famous of Australian explorers, the antipodean equivalents of Lewis and Clark, which is perhaps a little curious, since their expedition accomplished almost nothing, cost a fortune, and ended in tragedy. Their assignment was straightforward, to find a route from the south coast at Melbourne to the Gulf of Carpentaria in the far north. Melbourne, at that time much larger than Sydney, was one of the most important cities in the British Empire, and yet one of the most isolated. To get a message to London and receive a reply took a third of a year, sometimes more. In the 1850s, the Philosophical Institute of Victoria decided to promote an expedition to find a way through the ghastly blank, as the interior was poetically known, which would allow the establishment of a telegraph line to connect Australia first to the East Indies and onward to the world. They chose as leader an Irish police officer named Robert O'Hara Burke, who had never seen real outback, was famous for his ability to get lost even in inhabited areas, and knew nothing of exploration or science. The surveyor was a young English doctor named William John Wills, whose principal qualifications seemed to have been a respectable background and a willingness to go. On the plus side, however, they both had outstanding beards. Although by this time expeditions into the interior were hardly a novelty, this one particularly caught the popular imagination. Tens of thousands of people lined the route out of Melbourne when, on August 19, 1860, the Great Northern Exploration Expedition set off. The party was so immense and unwieldy that it took from early morning until 4 p.m. just to get it moving. Among the items Burke had deemed necessary for the expedition were a Chinese gong, a stationary cabinet, a heavy wooden table with matching stools, and grooming equipment, in the words of the historian Glenn McLaren, of sufficient quality to prepare and present his horses and camels for an agricultural society show. Almost at once the men began to squabble. Within days, 6 of the party had resigned, and the road to Menindee was littered with provisions they decided they didn't need, including 1,500 pounds, let me just repeat that, 1,500 pounds of sugar. They did almost everything wrong. Against advice, they timed the trip so that they would do most of the hardest traveling at the height of summer. With such a burden, it took them almost 2 months to traverse the 400 miles of well-trodden track to Menindee. A letter from Melbourne normally covered the same ground in 2 weeks. At Menindee, they availed themselves of the modest comforts of Maiden's Hotel, rested their horses and reorganized their provisions, and on October 19th set off into a blank ghastlier than they could ever have imagined. Ahead of them lay 1,200 miles of murderous ground. It was the last time that anyone in the outside world would see Burke and Wills alive. Progress through the desert was difficult and slow. By December, when they arrived at a place called Cooper's Creek, just over the Queensland border, they had progressed only 400 miles. In exasperation, Burke decided to take 3 men, Wills, Charles Gray, and John King, and make a dash for the Gulf. By traveling light, he calculated that he could be there and back in 2 months. He left 4 men to maintain the base camp, with instructions to wait 3 months for them in case they were delayed. The going was much tougher than they had expected. Daytime temperatures regularly rose to over 140 degrees Fahrenheit. It took them 2 months rather than 1 to cross the interior, and their arrival, when at last it came, was something of an anticlimax. A belt of mangroves along the shore kept them from reaching, or even seeing, the sea. Still, they had successfully completed the first crossing of the continent. Unfortunately, they had also eaten 2/3 of their supplies. The upshot is that they ran out of food on the return trip and nearly starved. To their consternation, Charles Gray, the fittest of the party, dropped dead one day. Ragged and half-delirious, the three remaining men pushed on. Finally, on the evening of April 21st, 1861, they stumbled into base camp to discover that the men they had left behind, after waiting 4 months, had departed only that day. On a coolabah tree was carved the message, "Dig, 3 feet northwest, April 21st, 1861. They dug and found some meager rations and a message telling them what was already painfully evident, that the base party had given up and departed. Desolate and exhausted, they ate and turned in. In the morning they wrote a message announcing their safe return and carefully buried it in the cache. So carefully, in fact, that when a member of the base party returned that day to have one last look, he had no way of telling that they had made it back and had now gone again. Had he known, he would have found them not far away, plodding over rocky ground in the impossible hope of reaching a police outpost 150 miles away at a place called Mount Hopeless. Burke and Wills died in the desert, far short of Mount Hopeless. King was saved by aborigines, who nursed him for 2 months until he was rescued by a search party. Back in Melbourne, meanwhile, everyone was still awaiting a triumphal return of the heroic band, so news of the fiasco struck like a thunderbolt. "The entire company of explorers has been dissipated out of being," the Age newspaper of Melbourne reported with frank astonishment. "Some are dead, some are on their way back. One has come to Melbourne, and another has made his way to Adelaide. The whole expedition appears to have been one prolonged blunder throughout." When the final tally was taken, the cost of the entire undertaking, including the search to recover Burke's and Wills's bodies, came to almost £60,000, more than Stanley had spent in Africa to achieve far more. Even now the emptiness of so much of Australia is startling. The landscape we passed through was officially only semi-desert, but it was as barren an expanse as I had ever seen. Every 20 or 25 kilometers there would be a dirt track and a lonely mailbox signaling an unseen sheep or cattle station. Once a light truck flew past in a bouncing hell-for-leather fashion, spraying us with gravelly dinks and a coating of red dust that went on for half a mile. But the only other lively thing was the endless shaking, flubbity-dubbing of the axles over the corduroy road. By the time we reached White Cliffs in mid-afternoon, we felt as if we had spent the day in a cement mixer. Today it is all but impossible to believe that White Cliffs, a small blotch of habitations under a hard, clear sky, was once a boom town, with a population of nearly 4,500, a hospital, a newspaper, a library, and a busy core of general stores, hotels, restaurants, brothels, and gaming houses. Today, downtown White Cliffs consists of a pub, a launderette, an opal shop, and a grocery, cafe, gas station. The permanent population is about 80. They exist in a listless world of heat and dust. If you were looking for people with the tolerance and fortitude to colonize Mars, this would be the place to come. Because of the heat, most houses in town are burrowed into the faces of the two bleached hills from which the town takes its name. The most ambitious of these dwellings, and the principal magnet for the relatively few tourists who venture this far, is the dugout underground motel, a 26-room complex cut deep into the rocks on the side of Smith's Hill. Wandering through its network of rocky tunnels was like stepping into an early James Bond movie, in one of those subterranean complexes where the loyal minions of Smersh are preparing to take over the world by melting Antarctica or hijacking the White House with the aid of a giant magnet. The attraction of burrowing into the hillside is immediately evident when you step inside. A constant year-round temperature of 67 degrees. The rooms were very nice and quite normal, except that the walls and ceilings were cave-like and windowless. When the lights were off, the darkness and silence were total. I don't know how much money you would have to give me to persuade me to settle in White Cliffs. Something in the low zillions, I suppose. But that evening, as we sat on the motel's lofty garden terrace with Leon Hornby, the proprietor, drinking beer and watching the evening slink in, I realized that my fee might be marginally negotiable. I was about to ask Leon, a city man by birth and, I would have guessed, inclination, what possessed him and his pleasant wife Marge to stay in this godforsaken outpost, where even a run to the supermarket means a 6-hour round trip over a rutted dirt highway. But before I could speak, a remarkable thing happened. Kangaroos hopped into the expansive foreground and began grazing picturesquely, and the sun plonked onto the horizon like a stage prop lowered on a wire, and the towering western skies before us spread with color in 100-layered shades, glowing pinks, deep purples, careless banners of pure crimson, all on a scale that you cannot imagine, for there was not a scrap of intrusion in the 40 miles of visible desert that lay between us and the far horizon. It was the most extraordinarily vivid sunset I believe I have ever seen. "I came up here 30 years ago to build reservoirs on the sheep stations," Leon said, as if anticipating my question, "and never expected to stay, but somehow the place gets to you. I'd find these sunsets hard to give up, for one thing." I nodded as he got up to answer a ringing phone. "Used to be even nicer, once, a long time ago," Lisa said. "There's been a lot of overgrazing." "Here or all over?" I asked. "All over. Well, nearly. In the 1890s there was a really bad drought. They say the land's never really recovered, and probably never will." Later, Steve Trevor and I went down the hill to the White Cliffs Hotel, the local hostelry, and the appeal of the little town became more evident still. The White Cliffs was as nice a pub as I have ever been in. Not to look at, for Australian country pubs are nearly always austere and utilitarian places, with linoleum floors, laminated surfaces, and glass-doored coolers, but with a happy atmosphere. Much of this is a tribute to the owner, Graham Wellings, a chipper man with a firm handshake, a matinee-idle hairstyle, and a knack for making you feel as if he settled here in the hope that one day someone like you would drop by. I asked him what had brought him to White Cliffs. "I was an itinerant sheep shearer," he said. "Came here in 59 to shear sheep and just never left. It was a lot more remote back then. Took us 8 hours from Broken Hill, the roads were that bad. You can do it in 3 now, but back then the roads were rough as guts every inch of the way. We tumbled in here gasping for a cold beer, and of course there were no coolers in those days. Beer was room temperature, and room temperature was 110 degrees. No air conditioning either, of course. No electricity at all, unless you had your own generator." "So when did you get electricity in White Cliffs?" I asked. He thought for an instant. 1993, he said. I thought I had misheard him. "When?" "Just about 5 years ago. We have telly now, too," he added suddenly and enthusiastically. "Got that 2 years ago. He seized a remote control unit and pointed it at a television mounted on the wall. When it warmed to life, he ran through their choice of 3 channels, turning to us at each with an expression that invited staggered admiration. I have been in countries where people still ride wagons and gather hay with forks, and countries where the per capita gross domestic product would not buy you a weekend at a Holiday Inn. But nowhere before had I been invited to regard television as a marvel." He switched off and put the remote back on the shelf as if it were a treasured relic. "Yeah, it was a different world then," he said musingly. "Still is," I thought. Chapter 3. In the morning, Steve and Lisa escorted us back along the lonely dirt track to the paved highway at Wilconia, where we parted ways, they to go left to Menindi, Trevor and I to go right to Broken Hill, 197 kilometers away down a straight and empty highway, thus completing a large and irregular circle. We had an afternoon in Broken Hill and spent it seeing the sights. We drove out to Silverton, once a rowdy mining town, now virtually derelict but for a big pub, which is said to be the most photographed and filmed in Australia. It's not that there is anything wildly special about the pub. It's more that it gives the appearance of being in the middle of nowhere, while actually being conveniently handy to the air-conditioned amenities of Broken Hill. It's been used as a film location 142 times, in a town like Alice, Mad Max 2, and about every Australian beer commercial ever made. It now gets by, evidently, on the visits of film crews and of occasional tourists like us. Broken Hill has had tough times, too. Even by Australian standards, it's a long way from anywhere. 1,750 kilometers from Sydney, the state capital, where all the decisions are made, and its citizens have an understandable tendency to think of themselves as neglected. As recently as the 1950s, it had 35,000 people, against just 23,000 now. Its history dates from 1885, when a boundary rider checking fences chanced upon a load of silver, zinc, and lead in sumptuous proportions. Almost overnight, Broken Hill became a boomtown, and gave birth along the way to Broken Hill Proprietary Limited, still Australia's mightiest industrial colossus. At its peak in 1893, Broken Hill had 16 mines employing 8,700 miners. Today there is just one mine and 700 workers, which is the main reason for the population decline. Even so, that one mine produces more ore than all 16 mines together at their peak. The difference is that whereas before you had thousands of men crawling about in pokey shafts, today a handful of engineers with explosives blow out cathedral-sized chambers up to 300 feet high and the size of a football field, and, when the dust has settled and everyone's ears have stopped ringing, a team of workers on giant bulldozers comes along and scoops up all the ore. It's so vastly efficient that in only a decade or so all the ore will be gone, and quite what will become of Broken Hill is anyone's guess. Meanwhile, it's a nice little town with an air of busyness and prosperity that brings to mind one of those establishing shots you'd see in a 1940s Hollywood movie featuring Jimmy Stewart or Deanna Durbin. Its main street is lined with handsome buildings in a modestly exuberant Victorian style. Seeking refreshment, Trevor and I ventured into one of the many imposing hotels. And I should just note that in an Australian context, hotel can signify many things. A hotel, a pub, a hotel and pub, that stand on nearly every corner. This one was called Mario's Palace Hotel, and it was very grand from without. It covered half a block and had a large wraparound balcony employing a lot of intricate ironwork, though inside it had an underlit and musty air. The bar seemed to be open. A TV was playing silently in the corner. The signs were illuminated. But there was no one in attendance and no sounds of anyone nearby. Leading off the bar were several large rooms, a ballroom, a dining room, perhaps another ballroom, all looking as if they had been decorated at considerable expense in 1953 and not used since. A door led out into a hallway with a grand stairway. From the ground to the distant ceiling, a good three stories above us, the stairwell walls were divided into panels of different sizes by strips of wood, and some artist had filled each of them, scores in all, with a mural, some of them several feet across, some much smaller. They consisted entirely of romantic and idealized landscapes, showing herds of kangaroos sipping at billabongs, or swagmen gathered around a lonely coolabah tree. They were undeniably hokey, but charming even so, and without question from a gifted hand. Almost involuntarily we found ourselves advancing slowly up the stairs, moving with silent absorption from one image to the next. "Good, eh?" came a voice after a minute, and we turned to see a young man looking up at us and apparently not at all perturbed that we were making our way into the depths of his building. He was wiping his forearms with a cloth, as if he had been engaged in some large task, like cleaning out a cauldron. "They were done by a black fella named Gordon Way," he went on. "Pretty amazing bloke. He didn't sketch anything out or anything, didn't have any kind of a plan. He just picked up his paints and a brush and did it straight off. At the end of the day, there'd be a finished painting. Then he'd collect his pay from the owner and clear off. Go walkabout, you know? Sometime later, maybe a week or two, maybe a few months, he'd come back and knock off another one, collect some more money and clear off again, until eventually he'd done them all. Then he cleared off for good. What became of him? No idea. Don't think anyone knows. So where you fellas come from? America and Britain, I said, pointing appropriately. Long way to come. Expect you'll be wanting a cold beer then. We followed him into the bar, where he drew us two schooners of Victoria Bitter. Nice hotel, I said, not really meaning it. He looked at me faintly dubiously. Well, you can have it if you want. It's on the market. Oh yeah, how much for? $1,750,000. It took me a moment to form the words. That's a lot of money. He made a look of agreement. More than most people around here have got, that's for sure. Then he disappeared with a crate through the door behind him. We wanted to ask him more, and after a few minutes we wanted another beer, but he never did come back. The following morning we caught the second of the twice-weekly Indian Pacifics to Perth. In the deliciously air-chilled bar car of the train, Trevor and I spread out a map of Australia and discovered with astonishment that for all our hours of driving over the previous days, we had covered only the tiniest fraction of land surface, a freckle, almost literally, on the face of Australia. It is such an immense country, and we still had 3,227 kilometers of it to get through before we reached Perth. There was nothing to do but sit back and enjoy it. After the heat and dust of the outback, I was glad to be back in the clean, regulated world of the train, and I fell into its gentle routines with gratitude and relish. Train life, I decided, is hard to beat. At some point in the morning, generally when you have gone for breakfast, your bed vanishes magically into the wall, and in the evening just as magically reappears, crisply made with fresh sheets. 3 times a day you are called to the dining car, where you are presented with a thoroughly commendable meal by friendly and obliging staff. In between times there is nothing to do but sit and read, watch the endlessly unfurling scenery, or visit with your neighbor. Trevor, because he was young and full of life, and unaccountably had failed to bring any of my books to make the hours fly, felt restless and cooped up, but I wallowed in every undemanding minute of it. With all your needs attended to and no real decisions to make, you soon find yourself wholly absorbed with the few tiny matters that are actually at your discretion. Whether to have your morning shower now or in a while. Whether to get up from your chair and pour yourself another complimentary cup of tea, or be a devil and have a bottle of Victoria Bitter. Whether to stroll back to your cabin for the book you forgot, or just sit and watch the landscape for emus and kangaroos. If this sounds like a living death, don't be misled. I was having the time of my life. There's something wonderfully lulling about being stuck for a long spell on a train. It was like being given a preview of what it will be like to be in your 80s. All those things 80-year-olds appear to enjoy, staring vacantly out windows, dozing in a chair, boring the pants off anyone foolish enough to sit beside them, took on a special treasured meaning for me. This was the life. Our new complement of passengers seemed a livelier bunch. There was Phil, a printmaker from Newcastle in New South Wales. Rose and Bill, a sweet, quiet couple from England who were on their way to see their son, a mining engineer in Kalgoorlie. 3 white-haired guys from a lawn bowling club in Neutral Bay who drank like sailors on shore leave. And a wonderful, rake-thin, chain-smoking, perpetually wobbly drunk lady, whose name no one seemed to know, and whose response to any pleasantry of any type directed at her, "Good morning, sleep well, I'm Bill, and this is Trevor," was to cry yes, and give a prolonged, demented laugh, and take a sip of Shiraz. In such a crowd, the evenings tended to be nicely festive, so much so that my notes for the relevant periods are on matchbooks and the backs of beer coasters, and show a certain measure of elevated incoherence. G, attacked by camel in men's lav, Alice Springs, 1947. Great. Still, my recollection is of having a jolly nice time, and that is, of course, the main thing. On our second day out from Broken Hill, we entered the mighty Nullarbor. Many people, even Australians, assume Nullarbor is an Aboriginal term, but in fact it is a corruption of the Latin for no trees, and the name could not be more apt. For hundreds of miles the landscape is as flat as a calm sea, and unrelievedly barren. Just glowing red soil, tussocky clumps of blue bush and spinifex, and scattered rocks the color of bad teeth. In an area 4 times the size of Belgium, there is not a scrap of shade. It is one of the most forbidding expanses on earth. Just after breakfast, we entered the longest straight stretch of railroad line in the world, 297 miles without a hint of deviation. And in mid-morning we heaved into Cook, a community that makes White Cliffs look accessible and urbane. 500 miles from any real town to east or west, 100 miles from the nearest paved highway to the south, and over 1,000 to the north, Cook, population 40, exists solely to water, fuel, and otherwise service the trains that pass through. Beside the track stood a sign that said, "No food or fuel for next 862 kilometers." Rather a daunting thought, what? We had 2 hours to kill in Cook, goodness knows why so long, and everyone was allowed to get off and look around. It was agreeable to move about without having to steady yourself against a swaying wall every couple of paces, but the thrill of Cook swiftly palls. There was nothing much to it. A railway station and post office, a couple of dozen prefabricated bungalows standing on dusty ground, a little shop whose shelves were mostly bare, a shuttered community center, an empty school. It was the middle of summer vacation. A small open-air swimming pool, also closed, and an airstrip with a limp windsock. The heat was terrific. On every side, desert lapped at the town like floodwater. I was standing there with a map of Australia, surveying the emptiness and trying to conceive the ungraspable fact that if I walked north from here, I wouldn't come to a paved surface for 1,100 miles, when Trevor trotted up and told me we'd been given permission to travel for an hour in the locomotive, so that he could take photos. This was a rare treat and exciting news. Just before the train resumed its journey, we climbed aboard the locomotive with two replacement drivers, Noel Code and Sean Willis, who would take the train on to Kalgoorlie. They were genial and laid back, in their late 20s or early 30s. Their cab was snug and comfy, homey even, in a high-tech sort of way. It featured a fancy console with lots of switches and toggles, three shortwave radios and two computer screens, but also a number of domestic comforts, a kettle, a small refrigerator, an electric hot plate for cooking. Code drove. He flipped a couple of switches, moved a gear stick a fraction of an inch, and we were off. Within a couple of minutes, we were up to our cruising speed of 100 kilometers an hour. I sat quite still, fearful of touching anything that would get us on the evening news, and enjoyed the novel perspective of looking straight ahead. And what an ahead it is on the boundless Nullarbor. Before us stretched a single-line track, two parallel bars of shining steel, dead straight and painfully shiny in the sunshine, and hatched with endless rungs of concrete ties. Somewhere in the vicinity of a preposterously remote horizon, the two gleaming lines of steel met in a shimmery vanishing point. Endlessly, monotonously, we vacuumed up ties as we progressed, but however much we pressed onward, the vanishing point stayed always in the same place. You couldn't look at it, well, I couldn't look at it, without getting a headache. "How far is it to the next curve?" I asked. 360 kilometers, Willis answered. "Don't you go crazy out here?" "No," they replied in unison and with evident sincerity. "Do you ever see anything to break the monotony? Animals and so forth?" "A few roos," Code said. "A camel from time to time. Once in a while somebody on a motorbike."
"Really?"
On that, he indicated a rough dirt maintenance road that ran alongside the track. "Very popular with the Japanese for some reason. Something to do with an initiation into a club or something." "We saw a bloke on a bicycle the other week," Willis volunteered.
"No kidding. Japanese bloke. Was he all right?"
"Out of his mind, if you ask me, but he seemed all right. He waved."
"Isn't it awfully risky out there?"
"Nah, not if you keep to the track. There's 50 or 60 trains a week along this line, and nobody's going to leave you out here if you're in bother." We had arrived at a siding called Deacon, where the Indian Pacific had to pull over to let a freight train through, and where Trevor and I were to return to the passenger section. We hopped down from the locomotive and walked briskly back along the train toward the passenger cars. And you would walk briskly too, believe me, if you were outside a train with its motor running in the middle of a desert. At the door of the first passenger car, David Goodwin, the train manager, was waiting for us. He helped us up. It's a long way up onto a train when you haven't got a platform to start with, and we half fell in. Looking up, I discovered with a start that we were in the forbidden coach section. I have never felt so stared at in my life. As we followed David through the two coach cars, 124 pairs of sunken eyes sullenly followed our every move. These were people who had no dining car, no lounge bar, no cozy berths to crawl into at night. They had been riding upright for 2 days since leaving Sydney, and still had 24 hours to go to Perth. I am almost certain that if we had not had the train manager as an escort, they would have eaten us. We arrived in Perth at first light, and stepped from the train, glad to be back on solid ground, and feeling disproportionately pleased with our achievement.
I know that all that was required of us to get there was to sit passively for 72 hours. But still, we had done something that lots of Australians never do, namely, cross Australia. It is a lame and obvious conclusion to draw, but Australia truly does exist on a unique scale. It's not just a question of brute distance, though goodness knows there's plenty enough of that, but of the incredible emptiness that lies within all that distance. 500 miles in Australia is not like 500 miles elsewhere, and the only way to appreciate that is to cross the country at ground level. I couldn't wait to see more. Part 2. Civilized Australia, the Boomerang Coast. Chapter 4. You wouldn't think that something as conspicuous, as patently there as Australia, could escape the world's attention almost to the modern age. But there you are, it did. Less than 20 years before the founding of Sydney, it was still essentially unknown. For nearly 300 years, explorers had been looking for a conjectured southern continent, Terra Australis Incognita, some commodious mass that would at least partly counterbalance all that land that covered the northern half of the globe. In every instance, one of two things happened. Either they found it and didn't know they had, or they missed it altogether. In 1606, a Spanish mariner named Luis Valles de Torres sailed across the Pacific from South America and straight into the narrow channel, now called the Torres Strait, that separates Australia from New Guinea, without having the faintest idea that he had just done the nautical equivalent of threading a needle. 36 years later, the Dutchman Abel Tasman was sent to look for the fabled Southland and managed to sail 2,000 miles along the underside of Australia without detecting that a substantial landmass lay just over the left-hand horizon. Eventually he bumped into Tasmania, which he called Van Diemen's Land, after his superior at the Dutch East India Company, and went on to discover New Zealand and Fiji, but it was not a successful voyage. In New Zealand, Maoris captured and ate some of his men, not the sort of thing that looks good in a report, and he failed to find anything in the way of riches. On the way home, he passed within sight of the north coast of Australia, but, disheartened, accorded it no importance, and sailed on. That isn't to say that Australia had never felt a European footprint. From the early 17th century onward, mariners occasionally fetched up on its northern or western shores, often after running aground. These early visitors left a few names on maps: Cape Leeuwin, the Dampier Archipelago, the Abrolhos Islands, but saw no reason to linger in such a barren void and moved on. They knew there was something there, possibly a biggish island like New Guinea, possibly a mass of smaller islands like the East Indies, and they called this amorphous entity New Holland, but none equated it with the long-sought southern continent. Because of the random and casual nature of these visits, no one knows when Australia first fell under European gaze. The earliest recorded visit was in 1606, when a party of Dutch sailors under a William Jansz, or Jansoon, stepped briefly ashore in the far north, and as hastily retreated under a hail of Aboriginal spears. But it is evident that others had been there earlier still. A pair of Portuguese cannons, dating from no later than 1525, was found in 1916 at a place called Carenade Island on the northwest coast. Whoever left them would have been among the first Europeans to stray this far from home, but of this epochal visit not a thing is known. Even more intriguing is a map, drawn by a Portuguese hand and dating from roughly the same period, that shows not only a large landmass where Australia stands, but an apparent familiarity with the jogs and indentations of Australia's east coast, something supposedly not seen by outsiders for another 2.5 centuries. So when, in April 1770, Lieutenant James Cook and his crew aboard HMS Endeavour sighted the southeast corner of Australia and followed the coast 1,800 miles north to Cape York, it wasn't so much a discovery as a confirmation. Though Cook's voyage was unquestionably heroic, its first purpose was mundane. He'd been sent halfway around the world, to Tahiti, to measure a transit of Venus across the sun. Combined with measurements taken at the same time elsewhere, this would permit astronomers to calculate the distance of the Earth from the sun. It wasn't an especially complicated procedure, but it was important to get it right. An attempt during the last transit 8 years earlier had failed, and the next one wasn't due for another 105 years. Happily for science and for Cook, the skies stayed clear and the measurements were taken without setback or complication. Cook was now free to go off and fulfill the second part of his assignment, to explore the lands of the South Seas and bring home anything that looked scientifically interesting. To this end, he had with him a brilliant and wealthy young botanist named Joseph Banks. To say that Banks was a dedicated collector is to indulge in the drollest understatement. In the course of the Endeavour's 3-year voyage, he gathered up some 30,000 specimens, including at least 1,400 plants never seen before, at a stroke increasing the world's stock of known plants by about a quarter. Banks brought so many items back that the Natural History Museum in London has whole drawers full of objects that, 220 years later, await cataloging. The same voyage also made the first successful circumnavigation of New Zealand, confirming that it was not part of the fabled southern continent, as Tasman had optimistically concluded, but two islands. By any measure, it had been a good voyage, and we can assume an air of satisfaction as the Endeavour turned at last for home. So when, on April 19, 1770, 3 weeks out from New Zealand, Lieutenant Zachary Hicks cried, "Land ahoy!" at the sight of what turned out to be the extreme southeast tip of Australia, the Endeavour and its crew were already on something of a roll. Cook named the spot Point Hicks, it's now called Cape Everard, and turned the ship north. The land, they found, was not only larger than had been supposed, but more promising. For the whole of its length, the east coast was lusher, better watered, and more congenially provisioned with harbors and anchorages than anything that had been reported elsewhere in New Holland. It presented, Cook recorded, a very agreeable and promising aspect, with hills, ridges, plains, and valleys, with some grass, but for the most part covered with wood. This was nothing like the barren and savage wastes that others had met. For 4 months they headed up the coast. They stopped at a place Cook named Botany Bay, ran disastrously aground on the Great Barrier Reef, and finally, after making some urgent repairs, rounded the northernmost tip of the continent at Cape York. On the evening of August 21st, almost as an afterthought, he stepped ashore at a place he called Possession Island, planted a flag, and claimed the east coast for Great Britain. It was a remarkable achievement for a man who had been born a labourer's son in inland Yorkshire, hadn't been to sea until he was 18, and had only joined the Navy 13 years before at the advanced age of 27. He would return twice more to the Pacific on even greater voyages. On the next he would sail 70,000 miles, before being murdered, and possibly eaten, by natives on a beach in Hawaii in 1779. Cook was a brilliant navigator and a conscientious observer, but he made one critical mistake on his first voyage. He took Australia's wet season for its dry one, and concluded that the country was more hospitable than it was. The significance of this misapprehension became evident when Britain lost its American colonies, and, deciding it needed a new place to send its less desirable subjects, plumped for Australia. Remarkably, the decision was taken without any attempt at reconnoitering. When Captain Arthur Phillip, at the head of a squadron of 11 ships, known reverentially ever after as the First Fleet, set sail from Portsmouth in May 1787, he and the 1,500-odd people in his care were heading off to start a colony in a preposterously remote, virtually unknown place that had been visited just once, briefly, 17 years before, and had not seen a European face since. Never before had so many people been moved such a great distance at such expense, and all to be incarcerated. By modern standards, by any standards, really, their punishments were ludicrously disproportionate. Most were small-time thieves. Britain wasn't trying to rid itself of dangerous criminals so much as thin out an underclass. The bulk were being sent to the ends of the earth for stealing trifles. One famously luckless soul had been caught taking 12 cucumber plants. Another had unwisely pocketed a book called A Summary Account of the Flourishing State of the Island of Tobago. Most of the crimes smacked either of desperation or of temptation unsuccessfully resisted. Generally, the term of transportation was 7 years, but since there was no provision for their return, and few could hope to raise the fare, passage to Australia was effectively a life sentence. But then this was an unforgiving age.
By the late 18th century, Britain's statute books were plump with capital offences. You could be hanged for any of 200 acts, including, notably, impersonating an Egyptian. In such circumstances, transportation was quite a merciful alternative. The voyage from Portsmouth took 252 days, 8 months, and covered 15,000 miles of open sea. More than would seem strictly necessary, but they crossed the Atlantic in both directions to catch favorable winds. When they arrived at Botany Bay, they found it wasn't quite the kindly refuge they had been led to expect. Its exposed position made it a dangerous anchorage, and a foray ashore found nothing but sandflies and marsh. "Of the natural meadows which Mr. Cook mentions near Botany Bay, we can give no account," wrote a puzzled member of the party. Cook's descriptions had made it sound almost like an English country estate, a place where one might play a little croquet and enjoy a picnic on the lawn. Clearly he had seen it in a different season. As they stood surveying their unhappy situation, there happened one of those coincidences in which Australian history abounds. On the eastern horizon, two ships appeared and joined them in the bay. They were in the command of an amiable Frenchman, Count Jean-François de La Pérouse, who was leading a 2-year journey of exploration around the Pacific. Had La Pérouse been just a little faster, he could have claimed Australia for France and saved the country 200 years of English cooking. Instead, he accepted his unlucky timing with the grace that marked the age. La Pérouse's expression, when it was explained to him that Philip and his crew had just sailed 15,000 miles to make a prison for people who had stolen lace and ribbons, some cucumber plants, and a book on Tobago, must have been one of the great looks in history. But alas, there is no record of it. In any case, after an uneventful rest at Botany Bay, he departed, never to be seen again. Soon afterward, his two ships and all aboard were lost in a storm off the New Hebrides. Meanwhile, Philip, seeking a more amenable location, sailed up the coast to another inlet, which Cook had noted but not explored, and ventured through the sandstone heads that form its mouth. There he discovered one of the great harbors of the world. At the point where Circular Quay now stands, he anchored his ships and started a city. It was January 26, 1788. The date would live forever as Australia Day. Among the many small and interesting mysteries of Australia in its early days is where so many of its names come from. It was Cook who called the eastern coast New South Wales, and no one now has any idea why. Did he mean to signify that this would be a new Wales of the South, or merely a new version of South Wales? If the latter, why just South Wales and not the whole of it? No one now can say. What is certain is that he had no known connection to that verdant principality, southerly or otherwise. Sydney, likewise, is a curious appellation. Philip intended the name only to apply to the cove. He meant for the town to be known as Albion, but that name never took. We know for whom Sydney was named, Thomas Townshend, 1st Baron Sydney, who was Home and Colonial Secretary, and therefore Philip's immediate master. What we don't know is why Townshend, when he was ennobled, chose Sydney as his title. The reason died with him, and the title didn't last much longer. It was extinct by 1890. The harbor itself was called Port Jackson. It is officially still so known, after an admiralty judge, one George Jackson, who later abandoned his birth name in order to secure an inheritance from an eccentric relation, and finished his life as Duckett. Of the roughly 1,000 people who shuffled ashore, about 700 were prisoners, and the rest were marines and officers, officers' families, and the governor and his staff. The exact numbers of each are not known, but it hardly matters. They were all prisoners now. They were, to put it mildly, a curious lot. The complement included a boy of 9 and a woman of 82, hardly the sort of people you would invite to help you through an ordeal. Though it had been noted in London that certain skills would be desirable in such a remote situation, no one had actually acted on that observation. The party included no one proficient in the natural sciences, no master of husbandry, not a soul who had the faintest understanding of growing crops in hostile climes. The prisoners were, in nearly every practical respect, woeful. Among the 700, there was just one experienced fisherman, and no more than 5 people with a working knowledge of the building trade. Philip was by all accounts a kindly man of even temper and natural honesty, but his situation was hopeless. Confronted with a land full of plants he had never seen and knew nothing about, he recorded in despair, "I am without one botanist, or even an intelligent gardener." Gamely, they made the best of things. They had no choice. Parties were sent into the countryside to see what they could find. Essentially nothing. A government farm was set up on ground overlooking the harbor, where the botanical gardens now stand, and attempts were made to establish friendly relations with the natives. The Indians, as they were at first generally called, were bewilderingly unpredictable. Generally friendly, they would nonetheless opportunistically attack settlers who ventured out of camp to fish or forage. In the first year, 17 colonists were picked off in this way, and scores more wounded, including Governor Philip himself, who approached an Aborigine at Manly Cove in an attempt to converse, and, to his consternation, had a spear thrust into his shoulder and out the back. He recovered. Nearly everything was against them. They had no waterproof clothes to keep out the rain, and no mortar to make buildings. No plows with which to till fields, and no draft animals to pull the plows they didn't have. The ground everywhere seemed cursed with an unconquerable sterility. Such crops as managed to push through the soil were, more often than not, stolen under cover of darkness, by marines as often as by prisoners. For years, both groups would want, not just for food, but for nearly every basic commodity one could name. Shoes, blankets, tobacco, nails, paper, ink, ground sheets, saddlery, whatever, in short, required manufacture. The soldiers did their best to evaluate their resources, but most had little idea of what they were looking for when they went after it, or at when they found it. The historian Glenn McLaren quotes one report from a soldier sent to the Hunter River Valley to see what might be there. "The soil is black," the soldier wrote hopefully, "but mixed with a sort of sand or marly substance. Fish also are plenty, and I suppose, from their leaping, are of the trout kind." Development was further set back by the need to rely on prisoners, who clearly lacked any basis for devotion beyond self-interest. The cannier ones soon learned to lie their way to softer duties. One fellow named Hutchinson, coming across some scientific apparatus that had been packed away in one of the holds, persuaded his superiors that he knew all there was to know about dyestuffs, and spent months conducting elaborate experiments with beakers and scales, until it gradually became apparent that he didn't have the faintest idea what he was doing. When they couldn't fool their masters, the prisoners could often fool their fellows. For years there existed an illicit commerce in which newly arrived convicts were sold maps showing them how to walk to China. Up to 60 at a time fled their captivity in the belief that that magically accommodating land lay just the other side of a vaguely distant river. By 1790 the government farm had been abandoned, and, with no sign of relief from England, they were desperately dependent on their dwindling supplies. It wasn't just that the food was short, but by now years old and barely edible, the rice so full of weevily grubs that every grain was a moving body, as Watkin Tench queasily noted. At the height of their crisis, they awoke one morning to find that half a dozen of their remaining cattle had wandered off, not to be seen again. These were seriously at-risk settlers. There was at times a kind of endearing quality to their hopelessness. When Aborigines killed a convict named McIntyre, Governor Philip, in an uncharacteristic fury, this was not long after he had been speared, dispatched a band of Marines on a punitive expedition with orders to bring back 6 heads, any 6. The Marines tramped about in the bush for a few days, but managed to capture just 1 Aborigine, and he was released when it was realized he was a friend. In the end, they captured no one, and the matter seems to have been quietly forgotten. Exhausted by the stresses, Philip was called home after 4 years and retired to Bath. Apart from founding Sydney, he had one other notable achievement. In 1814, he managed to die by falling from a wheelchair and out of an upstairs window. It is impossible, in the Frappuccino heaven that is modern Sydney, to get the slightest sense of what life was like in those early years. Partly this is for the obvious reason that things have moved on a bit. Where 200 years ago there stood rude huts and sagging tents, today there rises a great and comely city,
a transformation so total that it is impossible to see both ends at once, as it were. But there is also the consideration that the nature of Australia's beginnings is, even now, a tiny bit fudged, if not actually suppressed. Nowhere in the city will you find a monument to the First Fleet. Go to the National Maritime Museum, or Museum of Sydney, and you will certainly get an impression that some of the early residents experienced privations. You might even deduce that their presence was not completely voluntary, but the idea that they arrived in chains is somewhat less than manifest. In his great and majestic history of the country's early years, The Fatal Shore, Robert Hughes notes that until as late as the 1960s, Australia's convict beginnings were not deemed worthy of scholarly attention, and certainly not taught in school. John Pilger, in A Secret Country, writes that in his Sydney boyhood in the 1950s, even among the family one never made reference to the stain, the curiously menstrual euphemism by which convict antecedents were acknowledged. I can personally affirm that to stand before an audience of beaming Australians and make even the mildest quip about a convict past is to feel the air conditioning immediately elevated. Personally, I think Australians ought to be extremely proud that from the most awkwardly unpropitious beginnings, in a remote and challenging place, they created a prosperous and dynamic society. That is exceedingly good going. So what if dear old Gramps was a bit of a sticky-fingered felon in his youth? Look what he left behind. And so once more to Circular Quay in Sydney, where Governor Phillip and his straggly, salt-encrusted band stepped ashore 2 centuries ago. I was back in Australia after a trip home to fulfill some other commitments and to prepare for my real trip, my present trip. And now I was back and feeling, I have to say, pretty perky. The sun was gorgeously plump, the city coming to life. Shutters were rattling open, chairs being set out at cafes, and I was basking in that sense of wonder and delight that comes with being freed from a sealed airplane and finding myself once again down under. I was about to see Sydney at last. Life cannot offer many places finer to stand at 8:30 on a summery weekday morning than Circular Quay in Sydney. To begin with, it presents one of the world's great views. To the right, almost painfully brilliant in the sunshine, stands the famous Opera House, with its jaunty, severely angular roof. To the left, the stupendous and noble Harbour Bridge. Across the water, shiny and beckoning, is Luna Park, a Coney Island-style amusement park with a maniacally grinning head for an entrance. It's been closed for many years, but some heroic soul keeps it spruce and gleaming. Before you, the spangly water is crowded with the harbor's stout and old-fashioned ferries, looking for all the world as if they have been plucked from the pages of a 1940s children's book with a title like Thomas the Tugboat, disgorging streams of tanned and lightly dressed office workers to fill the glass and concrete towers that loom behind. An air of cheerful industriousness suffuses the scene. These are people who get to live in a safe and fair-minded society, in a climate that makes you strong and handsome, in one of the world's great cities, and they get to come to work on a boat from a children's storybook, across a sublime plane of water, and each morning glance up from their heralds and telegraphs to see that famous opera house and inspiring bridge and the laughing face of Luna Park. No wonder they look so damned happy. It is the opera house that gets all the attention, and you can understand why. It's so startlingly familiar, so, hey, I'm in Sydney, that you can't stop looking at it. Clive James, the Sydney-born critic, once likened the Opera House to a portable typewriter full of oyster shells, which is perhaps a tad severe. In any case, the Opera House is not about aesthetics, it's about being an icon. That it exists at all is a small miracle. It's difficult to conceive now just what a backwater Sydney was in the 1950s, forgotten by the world, and overshadowed even by Melbourne. As late as 1953, there were just 800 hotel rooms in the city, barely enough for one medium-sized convention, and not a thing to do in the evenings. Even the bars closed at 6 p.m. The city's capacity for mediocrity cannot be better illustrated than by the fact that where the Opera House now stands, on as fine a situation as water and land afford, was then the site of a municipal tram garage. Then two things happened. Melbourne was awarded the 1956 Summer Olympics, a call to action for Sydney if ever there was one,
and Sir Eugene Goossens, head of the Sydney Symphony Orchestra, began to agitate for a concert hall in a city that didn't have a single decent orchestral space. Thus goaded, the city decided to tear down the ramshackle tramshed and build something glorious in its place. A competition was held for a suitable